I thought it'd be nice to start with breathing in, breathing out. I am blooming as a flower. I'm fresh as the dew. I'm solid as a mountain. I'm firm as the earth. I am free. Breathing in, breathing out. I am water reflecting what is real, what is true. And I feel there's space deep inside of me. I am free. I am free. I am free. So let's sing it together. Breathing in, breathing out. Practices in our tradition is the practice of listening, and it's something, you know, we're really practicing all the time. When the bell invites us, you know, we stop and we breathe and we really hear the sound of the bell. And you know, somehow it's really easy to listen to the natural world or sounds that we think are really beautiful. But it's also natural that when we're talking with people and somebody says something we agree with, then, oh, I really like that person, you know, they agree with me. Versus, and if somebody says something we don't agree with, we think, well, maybe I don't like that person so well. They aren't agreeing with me. and you know, so we get caught in sort of this place of judgment. And it separates us from ourselves and each other. And in Dharma discussion, there's a way in which we can understand our hearing as like a bowl. And there can be a bowl that's overturned. And if we're listening like an overturned bowl, that means that we don't let anything in. We don't let our hearts, our minds, our bodies be open to what's being said. We might just have an argument with it, you know. But we our bowl is closed. There's another way to listen, like a bowl that has a lot of holes in it, and that is just whatever is said just flows right through, and it doesn't resonate, doesn't have any place to be held. And then there's the third way, which is where we listen, and there's a bowl, it's like a bowl with poison in it. And whatever somebody says, we judge it. I don't like that. I don't agree with that. There's something wrong with that. And those are the three bowls that we want to leave outside of our discussion groups. And instead, we want to bring a bowl that is turned up and open, is upright and empty. So that the bowl of our listening can be receptive. And hold what is said. And let it reflect. And not immediately jump to ideas or what we want to say back or dismissal. It's really important, you know, pay attention to what comes up and just breathe and be spacious and upright in our listening. And sometimes in that really open, spacious place, and this is a really important part of practice, so I'll talk about more this week as well, in that open, spacious place, and it often can be a place of kind of wondering, of curiosity, of interest, of inquiry even. But it's spacious, and in that spaciousness, something other than our usual patterned way of being in the world has a possibility of arising. And that's the freedom that we just sang about. And our practice is very much about discovering that freedom in everything we do throughout the day, in our sitting meditation, in our relationship with each other, in hearing the sounds, in our own hearts, minds, and body. So I wanted to speak a little bit about body today, because so often it's when we can come back to be present in our body, when we can let go a little bit of our busyness or distraction, and our body is here, it's solid. It's easy to come back to our body in a way that sometimes is not so easy to come back to our mind. It's tangible. And when we are able to come back to our body, our individual body, we can touch our relationship to ourselves. And when we really come back to our body, also we find our place. Because our only place is here. And when we really come back to our body, we find our community as well. I think one of the diseases of the 21st century includes this uncertainty about ourselves and our place. We have this nagging suspicion that we might be better off somewhere else, or doing something else, or being a different way. It's like being in perpetual exile. And we don't discover our own lives, and we don't discover the world by a journey of covering a lot of distance. And no matter how many miles we cover, we don't discover the world. But only we really discover ourselves and the world through a spiritual journey. And it might be a journey of just one step. But when we fully and completely relinquish ourselves, surrender ourselves to that step, that place, it's both humbling and joyful. Because we arrive at the ground of our own feet and we learn to be home. And in that one moment, We heal the exile. And it really is the only way to heal ourselves is just in this one moment. It's not out there. It's not in the future. It's not in the past. It's only by coming back and claiming our true place, our true being in this moment. And we find this body with all its weaknesses, frailties, and imperfections, just as we are. And we find this place, this gift of walking in nature and beauty. And at the same time, we know the oceans are rising as the sun shines. And we find this community. There's a story I've heard about a Christian community in Eastern Europe, and it was a community that was getting smaller and smaller. There were fewer and fewer monks living there. And within the community, you know, everybody had their responsibility. There was a brother who was in charge of repairing the chairs and tables, and another brother that was in charge of cooking, another brother that was in charge of growing the food. And they'd gotten to a place where they were not so happy about what was happening in their monastery. And the brother who was repairing the chairs was always upset because the cook always leaned back on his chair, and you know how that weakens chairs, and so he was always having to repair that chair over and over again, even though he'd ask the cook, please don't do that, it just makes a lot of work for me. And the cook was upset with the gardener because sometimes he would bring food that was really dirty or wasn't as so fresh. He would pick it 2 days before and leave it in the shed and then bring it in and it wouldn't look so fresh. And the cook would say, how can I feed the monastery when I get this kind of food? How can I present delicious food? And the gardener was upset with the man in the wood shop because he never left enough room in the wood shop for him to put the vegetables after he'd harvested them. You know, he was always moving them out of the way, and sawdust was getting on them. And so there was a sense of dissension, and the abbot of the monastery was aware of the dissension and didn't know what to do because they were all old and there was no young people coming. And so he walked down to the nearest village, and he went to the rabbi in that village, and he asked him, you know, Rabbi, there seems to be some difficulty in our community, and we're getting really small, and there's no one to replace us after we've died, and I'm not really sure what we should do about that. And you know, the rabbi and the abbot sat together for a little bit and in quiet, and then finally the rabbi said, I think one of you up there at the monastery is Jesus. And of course the abbot said, well, who? And he said, I don't know who. But go back to your monastery and share that with the brothers. That one of you is Jesus. And so he did. The abbot went back, and they all said, what did the rabbi say? What did the rabbi say? And the abbot said, he said, one of us is Jesus. And they all looked at each other. And the cook decided that no matter what kind of food that the gardener brought to him, if he cooked it with enough love, it would be delicious. And after all, the gardener might be Jesus. And the woodworker, every time the cook's chair got loose, took the chair and thought, wow, this might be where Jesus sits. And so he lovingly repaired it and put it back really close so that it was comfortable and in the right place for the cook to be able to sit in any way that he wanted to sit. And the woodworker decided, because the gardener might be Jesus, he didn't want to get sawdust all over the food. In fact, he thought, well, maybe when the food's left in the shed, I'll clean it up, I'll wash it. And because the gardener might be Jesus, but it might be the cook, too. And want to make it easy for both of them. And there's a very beautiful poem that we read in our sutra book called and the first line of it goes, all beings by nature are Buddha. As ice by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. It's a song of, we could call it mindfulness, song of Zazen, song of realization. So this spiritual journey of one step begins by letting go of our ideas, our perceptions, our views of who we are and who each other is. In some ways, it's kind of a surrender to things as they are in this moment. I have a background in biology, so I in science, and I really like turning to science. Because science points to something that we don't see, but we believe it. We don't know. I was thinking this morning as we were doing walking meditation on this floor, this beautiful maple floor, how with each step we were touching the trees. And trees are seemingly outside of us and separate from us. And yet if we look really closely at trees, if we look at the real science of trees, we see they really aren't separate from us, outside of us. At one level. You know, one of the really wonderful things about trees is the only way that the sun's energy can be captured and made available to us, any green things, is through the chlorophyll taking the energy of the sun. That's our energy. That's how it, we can't do that for ourselves. We can't make sunlight into energy. And the energy to take a step is the energy of the sun, is the energy of the trees. And chlorophyll is, chemically it's a ring, and in the center of it there's a magnesium atom. And it is the exact same chemical ring as hemoglobin. But hemoglobin has an atom of iron in the middle of it. Not so different. I think that's wonderful. We breathe the breath of trees. Every breath we take, we are taking in trees. Every step we take, we are taking the energy of trees and making it alive through us. And so when we look at anything in this way, whether we look at rain, water, the earth, sun, stars, we can see that there really is no separation, no division through space. There's something consistent that runs through all of us, all of it. And we're part of that. We can't really grasp that too much with our intellectual mind, but we believe it because science tells us this. And there's another really interesting way of looking at this deep sense of interbeing. It's through deep time. Through deep space, we see there's no separation. And through deep time, we also see there's no separation. And there's a really wonderful maple tree that we'll walk by today in our walking meditation. Probably stop and look at it. It's an ancestor at maple tree. I don't know how many hundreds of years old it is. It manifests ancestors, and it also manifests Buddha. When the spring comes, there's a seed that forms, and those seeds fall from the tree. And when you hold that seed and look at the seed, you can see that everything that that tree is can come forth from that seed. And you know, over time it'll change and it'll look totally different, but the seed is still in the tree. It's different. And at the same time, it's exactly the same. In the study of embryology, there's this wonderful phrase that says, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It's one of my favorite phrases. And again, this is something the science points to, that in the development of a fetus, it goes through all the phases of evolution. There's a time when a fetus is like a fish. There's a time when it's like a reptile. Bit by bit, it turns into, goes through the stages of evolution, manifesting into a human being, ultimately. Starting from one single cell. Everything that ever existed is within us. Everything that is going to exist is also here. And you know, it's really not just an intellectual understanding. There's something here to experience, to realize for ourselves, that the inward journey includes all things. I know often when we come on retreat and we think, we're separating ourselves from our busy life. We're separating ourselves so that we can be quiet inside. and go inward. And yet when we do touch that wide, spacious stillness where our mind begins to rest, our ideas of this and that, near and far, future and past fall away, then we find what is here is the entire body. Past, present, future, and throughout space. And we realize it in the particular and the specific and the immediate moment. Touching the earth with this step. And if we don't let go of our ideas of where we're going or where we came from, then we can't really experience this step. We can't know what's right here. So we practice sitting meditation to really be able to come back to have that much concentration, that much focus, that we can touch that stillness. Letting go of who we think we are. Letting go of what we think of the world even. And instead surrendering to what is actually here. And there's a great spaciousness, a kind of freedom in that kind of surrender. It allows all things to be present within us, within a kind of mystery, and that we can hold that mystery without having to define it, without having to make it into something solid, without having to hold on to anything, because each moment is brand new. So the practice of coming back to our body as a big body, not to include all things, is really an act of love. And it's not just an act of love between one person and another, between loving this moment, because it's only an act of love if we can let go. I know in relationships, I've talked with many people who have found that in a relationship, the love that happens between two people is deepened and made more true only through letting go. If we are trying to hold on to somebody, to turn them into who we want them to be, if we are trying to hold something that is impermanent as permanent, we destroy it. And so the only way to really love another person is to let them be free. To accept the natural changing that happens. It's by letting go of love, our idea of what it is to be in love, that we can experience true love. Remember when my dad was dying? It was very hard for my mother. She worked very hard to take care of him. And in that taking care was trying to make him better. Trying to not be able to not let him go. And one afternoon, after a long time of his health going downhill, he sat up and he said, "I'm going now." He knew he was dying. And my mother didn't want to be in the room. And within a few hours, he had laid down again and had entered into some other kind of consciousness, I would say. And we suggested to my mother that she get in bed with him and hold him. And she said, no, she wouldn't do that. She couldn't do that. There's just too much acknowledgement, I think, of losing him. And so she went to bed, and then about midnight she woke up and she came out, and without saying anything to anyone, she crawled into bed with him and put her arms around him. And we were all just there breathing together. And after about 10 minutes she said, I think he's gone now. That last act of love of hers was a deep letting go of what she thought it should be. It was an unconditional act of love for my father, just exactly where he was. And something really amazing, I think, happened there. I mean, of course, this is surmise, but my father lost his mother when he was an infant in the flu epidemic of 1917-1918. And I think my mother crawling into bed with him and holding him in those last minutes when he was clearly in a different consciousness, clearly in a different space, was some deep healing for him that was necessary for him to let go. And there was no separation there with past, present, or future. There's no separation between my mother and my father. A very deep healing happened in the room, and you could touch it. It was a kind of act of love that transcends what we think, what we want, how it should be. And letting things be just as they are, deep, pure, spacious. And that love is not something that we make, but it is something that we are part of. It's always present in our body, in the world, in the breathing of trees. In the breathing of you and me. We arise from that. And even in our sense of exile, it's expressing itself through our frailty and through our imperfections. And It's a mystery. And surrendering all our knowing, all our ideas, our perceptions and views of who we are, who each other is, what the world is. All that nagging uncertainty that we keep trying to cover over with our assuredness. Letting go of all of it. Things just as they are the body of love. So our practice isn't to create that or make that happen, but to uncover what is already true about ourselves, about the world. And we do that simply by letting go and coming back, entrusting ourselves over and over again to this breath, this step, this smile, this sip of water. And I'd just like to end with a poem by Wendell Berry that I think points lovely to, in a lovely way to this. Like the water of a deep stream, love is always too much. We did not make it. Though we drink till we burst, we cannot have it all or want it all. In its abundance, it survives our thirst. In the evening, we come down to the shore to drink our fill and sleep while it flows through the regions of dark. It does not hold us, except we keep returning to its rich water, thirsty. We enter, willing to die, into the commonwealth of its joy. This kind of love is eternal, and it is eternity. It transcends space, it transcends time, and we, all the time, are manifesting it in every act. It comes alive. But we only can really touch it by letting go, by coming back, and by opening to the vast potential of knowing this true reality through ourselves. So the poem that Hakuin Zenji wrote ends, this very place is the lotus land. This very body is the Buddha. And when we touch that, when we uncover that, in our own hearts and minds, in the world of no separation through space and time, then our deepest desire becomes simply to manifest that in the world. And however imperfectly we proceed, nevertheless, It is that great great body of the Buddha that holds us all and manifests through us. So in our time together, I want to say that, you know, we can't have a Sangha, can't have a community if we don't have the Buddha and the Dharma. The Buddha and the Dharma have to be part of our community. This deep desire to awaken for the sake of all beings, to practice the path for the sake of others, is the very basis and foundation by which our community lives, grows, and thrives together. We can't also have a Sangha without the Buddha and the Dharma being present. And as soon as we allow ourselves to surrender to that, then the Sangha is born. The temple of our practice lives. So there's something very wonderful about coming together like this on a retreat, because so much of the time in our daily lives we feel like we're all alone. And we're practicing the best we can. And we feel cut off from each other, which is that place of exile, and that we have to do something different or make something be different. The Sangha can exist right in that moment, by coming back to our breath and knowing that we are the body of the trees, we are the breath of the trees. By coming back and knowing that we are the manifestation of the sun, we are the body of the sun. And already there is the temple of our practice, and already there is our Sangha. I think our biggest job as lay people is finding ways to keep coming back to remember. To remember that the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are here. And every time we touch that aspiration to wake up, not just for me, but for the trees and the grasses, for the sunlight to wake up as well, then already the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are alive. And our exile has ended. It is something that we practice and experience, and not something that we have to figure out. It's something that we surrender into. Deep time, deep space. So we have a week together to practice this body. This body that includes the trees, that includes the geese, that includes the song of the red-winged blackbird, that includes you, includes me. So